The Honorable Justice Terry presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Welcome to the northern panel of the Nevada Supreme Court, Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons, and Justice Cherry. Our first case today is case number 55621, Ken Shamrock, Inc. versus Zuffa, Inc. Mr. Worthington for the appellant, Mr. Campbell for the respondent. Mr. Worthington, you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am. Good morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
Brian Worthington on behalf of appellant Ken Shamrock. As set forth in the brief, there were three issues at issue in this appeal. The first relates to whether Recital G set forth a unilateral option for Zuffa to provide a second bout to Mr. Shamrock. The second is whether termination of the contract under Subdivision 2 of 10.3 in the contract was proper at the time that it was made, and whether it was a breach of contract for Zuffa to terminate at the time it did. And the third is whether Mr. Shamrock waived his right to file suit by providing notice of the breach at the time that the district court contended he did. I would like to address, unless the court would proceed to go elsewhere, the 10.3 issue first, because that is the real core of this case. Paragraph 10.3 provides that Zuffa may make an election, and that is the actual word used in the contract, is an election. If Mr. Shamrock was to retire, that Zuffa was permitted to suspend the contract or terminate the contract. There was a third option that everyone agrees was not an issue here. Zuffa contends that it actually suspended the contract. There was no notice of that. As we set forth in our brief in great detail, it is Shamrock's position that notice of an election is required. Without notice of an election, Mr. Shamrock has no knowledge, no understanding of what his rights and obligations are at that time. As discussed in the briefs, there is a what you might refer to as a promotional exclusivity provision in the contract that restricts Mr. Shamrock from a number of potentially lucrative activities while the term of the contract is in effect. These include promoting bouts with other fight leagues, doing any type of color commentating, merchandising, which, as is commonly known, can be extremely lucrative. If there's no notice of an election provided, meaning Mr. Shamrock doesn't know if the contract is suspended or if it's terminated, Mr. Shamrock has no knowledge of whether his promotional exclusivity obligations are in place. It is therefore,
aren't you over-reading paragraph 10.3 a bit? It doesn't say Zuffa must make an election and give notice. It says Zuffa may, at its election, do A, B, or C. And to my mind, there's no time stated on when it must suspend or declare that Zuffa has satisfied its obligation. It did declare that Zuffa satisfied its obligation when your client came and asked for another round or another bout.
It did.
So you're reading a lot into may at its election, which is permissive rather than mandatory.
It is. That's true. Zuffa was not required to make any election at all. And if they had not made any election here, Mr. Shamrock would have been fine to permit the term of the contract to go at its stated term. However, Zuffa contends that it did make an election. And while paragraph 10.3 does not state a specific time,
it made a declaration that it had no further obligations.
It did that after Mr. Shamrock had already announced he had come out of retirement. It said that it was terminating the contract. Everyone agrees that 10.3 subdivision 2 essentially constitutes the right to terminate the contract.
Right.
And it made that announcement 8 months after Mr. Shamrock had announced his retirement and weeks after Mr. Shamrock had announced he was coming out of retirement.
Mr. Worthington, is this issue an issue of law for us to review on contract interpretation, or is it a mixed issue of law and fact that we have to review it under that standard from the district court?
It's an issue of law with a de novo review because it is our position that the contract is unambiguous in this regard. A contract is ambiguous if it is subject to two or more reasonable interpretations. This contract, and paragraph 10.3 specifically, is subject only to one reasonable interpretation because, again, for Zuffa to be able to make an election 8 months after Mr. Shamrock announces his retirement and even after he came out of retirement is unreasonable because during that entire time, Mr. Shamrock was complying with his promotional exclusivity obligations, foregoing all of those other lucrative opportunities. He was enduring the burden of the contract, but he was getting no benefit because ultimately, when he said he came out of retirement, he expected the benefit of a second fight, and Zuffa simply said, no, I'm sorry, now we're changing our election. We contend that we suspended originally, and we're making a second election. We're changing our mind. And we're saying that the contract is now terminated. And that's an unreasonable interpretation that Zufa would be allowed to change its mind and make a second election like that. And so that's why it is an issue of law of de novo review, because it's the only reasonable interpretation.
Thank you.
So you're reading in a time limit on the obligation to declare the contract at an end.
We see that as the only reasonable interpretation of that paragraph under the circumstances of this contract with the promotional exclusivity requirements. Without some type of reasonable time period of providing notice of what election Zufa is making, Mr. Shamrock is entirely unclear as to what his rights and obligations are under the contract.
But he didn't provide for a time limit on that declaration in the contract, correct?
The contract does not, paragraph 10.3 does not state a specific time. That is correct. But it is our position that...
I understand that. Yeah.
So with respect to the paragraph 10.3, it is, as I say, a questions of benefits and burdens. Every contract is supposed to provide a party with benefits and burdens. And when Zufa is permitted to make two elections, it is shifting the benefits and the burdens entirely. Zufa gets all the benefits with no burden. Mr. Shamrock gets all burden with no benefit. And this is really the other part of it here, because as Zufa contends, it suspended the term of the contract immediately after Mr. Shamrock retired. Zufa contended it was permitted to change its mind 8 months later and make a second election. That is also an unreasonable interpretation of the contract, because paragraph 10.3 provides for the three options that Zufa may do 1, 2, or 3. And the understanding of or is that it's in the disjunctive. One may make one choice out of three. The argument that Zufa made at trial and that the district court adopted was that or can mean and that in this instance, or does mean and. And the case that the district court relied upon is the desert irrigation case that's cited in all of the briefs. And in that case, this court said that or can mean and if it's necessary to avoid a dubious result. Doesn't say that or is automatically and. So the issue here is, would there be dubious results if or was interpreted as or and not and? And in fact, the result is quite the contrary. If Zufa is permitted to change 8 months after it makes its original election and after Mr. Shamrock already comes out of retirement, that leads to a dubious result because, again, during that entire 8 months, Mr. Shamrock is foregoing a number of other lucrative opportunities in merchandising, in color commentating, potentially promoting fights in other leagues, not to mention if he could have even been a fighter. There were contentions in the respondent's brief that Mr. Shamrock's fighting days were done. But paragraph 4.3, the exclusivity provisions, don't simply apply to fighting. It applies to all of these other potentially lucrative opportunities. So during that 8 month period of time, Mr. Shamrock is complying with those exclusivity provisions. And then when he announces he wants to come out of retirement because he wants to free himself of those exclusivity provisions, having endured that burden for 8 months, Zufa says, we're changing our mind, we're changing our election. That is a dubious result. And that is why or here needs to be interpreted as or and not and.
What about the waiver issue?
The waiver issue is a question of actually very well-established law. You, of course, can only have a waiver if there's an intentional relinquishment of a known right. Here, the district court's waiver determination was based upon the paragraph in the contract that required one party to give notice of a claimed breach and an opportunity to cure. However, there's a very well-established case law in this state and in many other jurisdictions that states that if one party to a contract commits an anticipatory repudiation of a substantial part of the contract, then another party's obligations to perform under the contract are waived. And that includes obligations to give notice and an opportunity to cure. And the cardinal phrase that's used to support that reasoning is that the law will not require a futile act.
Isn't waiver in part a factual question, though?
It typically is. Mm-hmm. Here it is not, though, and is subject to de novo review, because the district court went on to evaluate the facts about waiver, having made an interpretation of the contract that it required notice and an opportunity to cure. As the court well knows, interpretation of a contract, of an unambiguous contract, is a question of law. The district court here interpreted the contract as requiring notice of the breach and an opportunity to cure at that time. However, as a matter of law, because of the anticipatory repudiation of the contract, when Zufa breached the contract, that provision requiring notice and an opportunity to cure was no longer in effect because of the anticipatory repudiation. So that's where the legal issue is that the district court erred in the legal interpretation of the contract as requiring notice and an opportunity to cure at that time. Therefore, everything after that, all of the factual determinations that the district court made were essentially became mooted because the district court based its factual determination on an erroneous legal interpretation of the contract as requiring notice and an opportunity to cure.
I'm trying to recall from the briefs, did you or the respondent cite Maumon versus MGM on this issue? Do you recall?
I believe so.
Okay.
I'm trying, I can very quickly check that. Yes, we cited
well, the reason I mentioned it, I was the attorney for Maumon in that case, and we won arguing there was waiver, you know, in that issue. And I was joking with Justice Pickering because her firm was on the other side of that. It's almost 30 years ago. So we've forgotten about it until we reread it. But that case, it seemed to me the court concluded there was a factual, that you have to evaluate it under a factual basis. And in that case, the court said there was a genuine issue of material fact and reversed the summary judgment.
It is. And that's the case that supports the general rule that waiver is a factual issue. But once again, here we have a preceding issue that before you can even get to the waiver issue, because the court based its waiver evaluation on its determination that there was an obligation to give notice of the breach. And if the court erred in its legal interpretation that that notice was required, then the waiver issue essentially becomes moot. Because if no waiver is required, or I'm sorry, if no notice of the breach and opportunity to cure is required, then there can't be a waiver of the right to file suit, because the district court based its waiver argument entirely on the provision in the contract stating that that notice and an opportunity to cure were required by the unambiguous terms of the contract.
So your position is that they had to give you notice of their election, but you did not have to give notice of their breach, though as written the contract says the obverse.
Well, the difference is that Mr. Shamrock hadn't repudiated the contract. But our arguments also prevail even if there's no notice of an election required, because again, then that becomes down to the fact that two elections were made. Even if notice is not required, two elections were made, and we say that's improper. My time is up if I wish to have any rebuttal time, so unless there are further questions, I'll return.
Mr. Gibbons, Justice Pickard?
No.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes and 55 seconds left.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, on behalf of the respondent.
May it please this honorable court, I'd like to start with the topic of waiver, because in large measure that's what 2 days of trial testimony actually focused on. And I think it's extremely important here, and like all attorneys who are appearing before the Supreme Court, we're always worried about whether or not we have explained the facts in enough detail. So I'd like to just take just a few moments because I think they're absolutely critical. What we had in this particular case is we had a fighter that was indeed represented by an agent, Mr. Donahue. And that's really what the case is about, Mr. Donahue, Rodney Donahue. They are right, he was an agent, but he was something much more important than that. He was an attorney. He is a longtime practicing attorney in Los Angeles and Southern California that specializes in sports representation. He is also something else. He is the partner of Mr. Shamrock. And what Mr. Donahue did, and what we convinced the court of, was that he gained this entire controversy. That's exactly what he did. He tried to stack the deck against us and then tried to come in and say that he was entitled to something he was not. And this is how he did it. Mr. Shamrock, after being literally humiliated again within just a matter of months and falling to Mr. Ortiz in the first round again, stood up and said, "This sport has passed me by. I'm done. I am retiring." And we didn't hear peep one from him for almost 9 months. The suggestion that somehow he was foregoing all sorts of lucrative deals is nowhere in the record. The record is exactly the opposite, that he gained 75% of his income, and by the way, in just a matter of a year, he gained over $2 million from us. 75% of his income was from other activities, and those activities were his gyms, his cornering. He actually participated with an opposing league, the IFL, which is no longer in business. And in his participation, got stock options and was earning six figures a year. So this wasn't somebody that was, you know, completely prevented from doing anything. There was an express carve-out just for that, and he exercised his rights under it. We don't hear from him for almost 9 months, and then what we hear is he wants to come back. We say, come back? We never say, we made an election to suspend. We say it was suspended because it was a de facto suspension. And that's precisely what the GC at that time, Mr. Kirk Hendricks, said. He said it was essentially put on the shelf. We cannot make him fight. He makes that decision. We can't do anything. Of course it's suspended. But he came back a year later, and at the age of 43, and after having lost 8 of 11 fights, and having been embarrassed, and having, at that particular age, 43, suffered all of these losses, it was determined we are not going to put him in another UFC fight. If he wants to go out and he wants to fight somewhere else, he's not going to do it. And at the trial, Mr. White was asked, why did you make that determination you were not going to put him back in, not give him the second fight? He said he wasn't going to be the first death in the UFC. It's one thing fighting in the UFC. It's something entirely different fighting somewhere else. But Mr. White turned out to be entirely right, because it's later proved he went over to London, fought someone who was totally unheralded, and lost again in the first round, and then ultimately got suspended in California for steroid use.
So the UFC is not like other type of wrestling, which is kind of a
show type thing. Exactly, Your Honor. At this level of mixed martial arts, it is literally playing in Yankee Stadium. And it's one thing to be playing in Yankee Stadium and facing Mariano Rivera, and it's quite another to be playing at Cashman Field, facing somebody out of Long Beach State. And that's exactly what the situation was. And so we set to doing. And this lawyer, Mr. Donahue, then said to Mr. Henrick, in a letter, it was a trial exhibit 8, if you are making an election to go ahead and terminate it, then let me know. He never says, you can't make an election here. You've already made an election before. And he didn't say that because there was really no election. There was a de facto suspension. That's exactly what happened. But he doesn't say, you can't do it. Mr. White says, he's not coming back here. I don't want him to be hurt. So that's the end of the story. He can go. If he wants to fight someplace else, it's on somebody else's watch, not on mine. We are a privileged licensee. Mr. White was respectful of that fact. So what does Mr. Donahue do? He doesn't say, what are you talking about? You have to give it to him. I'm declaring a breach. He never puts him on notice of that at all. He does something entirely different. He engages in acquiescence and essentially an abandonment of the notion that he is legally entitled to something. He says, there's not much I can do about it. That's what he says in his own letter. There's not much I can do about it. We agree. It's pretty clear. We're entitled to do what we're doing. He understands that. He then goes on and he thanks us. Now, this is a lawyer. Can you imagine in a brief situation? He thanks us for all of our professional courtesies and kindnesses, and then says, why don't you let me draft the termination letter? And under cross-examination, Mr. Donahue was forced to admit that he had never asked to do that before, and this was very unusual that he would be crafting it. But Mr. Hendrick, not in his wildest dreams, thinks he's being set up on something and that the deck is being stacked, says, sure, go ahead, Rod. Go ahead and, craft one. So he sends it out. No reservation of rights at all on anything. And that's the first thing you do. You reserve all your rights. You demand a cure. Even if it's not in the documents that you're dealing with that control your situation, you demand it anyway. But he didn't even do that, and he was required to do it. That section specifically, 11.5, specifically says you've got to declare a breach, number one. Number two, you then have to demand a cure number two. And he didn't do either of those. Instead, we then send a closure letter after he prepares the termination letter for us. And we say, we're done. It's over. He doesn't say anything at that point. The reason he gave for not saying anything at that point, he said under cross-examination, was, oh, I didn't want to get anybody mad. Can you imagine a lawyer saying that? But he waited until the contract had expired, that entire 12 months ran, and he didn't have any problem sending a real nasty letter to us then, asking us to do one thing and one thing only, pay us $230,000. Mr. Donahue knew what we all knew. Mr. Shamrock could no longer fight in the UFC. That was later proven over in London when he got wiped out by an unheralded fighter in seconds. Later proved when he resorted to the use of steroids. He was done at 43 years of age. He didn't want him fighting in the UFC. And that's why he did what he did. He wanted a free payday. Now the court, and I understand that that two justices that were presently appearing in front of had a very, very similar case to this. And I understand what our Supreme Court said in there in reversing Judge Guy. But we have cited a case to the court as well that was just decided just literally a little over a year ago in Ohio, which is almost directly on point. It's the case of Mine Hylic versus Arctic Plumbing. And it's almost directly on point. Same sort of thing, provision of services and goods over a period of time. They said, well, we're just not going to do it. 5 months later, they come back and say, oh, no, you breached. Say, wait a second, we sent you all kinds of letters. We said, you know, we're not going to complete the contract. You can't come back and do this to us now. And that's exactly what the court said. There was clearly acquiescence and abandonment of their legal rights at that time.
Mr. Campbell, can you talk a little bit about the standard of review for us on these various issues?
Yes, Your Honor. On that, on the waiver, it is substantial evidence. And there's also the suggestion that there was no finding of estoppel. That's really not true. It wasn't a specific finding, but as this court has held and a number of the federal courts have held, it's not necessary for a district court judge to prepare elaborate findings on every possible issue raised at trial. And quite frankly, I think we all recognize waiver and estoppel are very, very close with one another. So that's substantial evidence. With respect to the issue of the Recital G, we believe that that's absolutely unambiguous. Am I out of time here?
No, you got 5 minutes left.
Okay. And on 10.3, certainly we believe that there was evidence considered in light of the fact that there was this claim that we could only make one election, and we've cited all of those cases, and I think we cited about 10 of them that and or, you know, means just that. It means and. Mm-hmm. It means or. It can mean both, and this court has so found on several occasions, as most other courts have throughout the United States. there was one particular matter that I wanted to address. These facts that I have just presented to you are completely undisputed. Those facts that we have just relied upon, and which Judge Johnson relied upon in making this specific finding that there had been a knowing waiver, that they had essentially gamed the system, were completely and totally undisputed in the record. Mr. Donahue was in the best position to claim that there was in fact a breach, and he had to do so at a time when it allowed us to react with legal remedies and rights and possible options that were never available until he sat on his rights and waited some 10 days after the expiration. That's all he waited, 10 days after the expiration of the year period of time, to then come up and say, no, I want another fight. Mr. Donahue did absolutely nothing. And his only reason proffered was that he didn't want to get anybody mad. What person thanks the individual that is breaching the contract in which he had a personal stake and interest? What person does that who is a lawyer? There's no lawyer on the planet that would ever do that. There's only one reasonable explanation and inference that can be drawn from that. He was, in fact, gaming the system, and he was, in fact, trying to set us up. And just as a matter of public policy, that reeks. There's something very wrong about that. And that's why you have cure provisions and mandatory declarations of breach, so you can recognize if you have a problem and work it out without coming to a court and taking up everyone's time. But that's not what he wanted, and that's not what he did. There was an additional matter that I wanted to raise with the court with respect to the finding of Judge Johnson. Judge Johnson's findings were her findings. They weren't our findings. She made these findings, and she spent a long time on them. And she cited chapter and verse where it was in the record.
16 pages worth of findings.
And the primary witness in this entire case was Mr. Donahue. And she personally examined him on occasions. So this is not someone that was detached or left all of these findings to someone else and just said, oh, I think this side wins, that side loses. Prepare them all and I'll sign off of them. This was a very engaged judge, a former commercial litigator herself, who made all of these particular findings. And to suggest, as I think my respected opposing counsel has done, that there is not substantial evidence in the record from which she could make these findings is simply not true based upon the record that is before the court. I have nothing further to add unless the court has
Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons, any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Worthington, what about was Donahue gaming the system here? Why don't you respond to that?
I apologize. I didn't hear what you said.
Was Mr. Donahue gaming the system?
He was not gaming. He was responding to what was done at the time. He did say that he didn't want to make anybody angry, but the issue was is that because he was acting more as an agent than he was acting as a lawyer at the time. He was trying to make sure there could have been some future relationship between Zuffa and Mr. Shamrock going forward. And he even testified to the fact that that's what he did. However, the concern that I have about Zuffa's arguments, both in its brief on the waiver issue and here today, is that Zuffa just tends to glide over this issue of the anticipatory repudiation and what that does to the notice provision. There's established case law that says that the anticipatory repudiation, the declaration of termination of the contract, a second election after the first election was made 8 months previously, the wrongful termination at that time was an anticipatory repudiation of the contract, and it excused the obligation of Mr. Shamrock to provide any type of notice. That is where the district court erred as a matter of law, was in this legal issue of interpreting the contract as requiring notice and an opportunity to cure after the anticipatory repudiation. Some other issues that Zuffa brought up today is they said that Mr. White was so concerned about Mr. Shamrock's health. The interesting thing about this is that the time when Mr. Shamrock announced he was coming out of retirement was within the initially contemplated one-year term of the contract. It was Mr. White himself who insisted that a second bout be provided for within the contract. This was not a free payday, as Mr. Campbell said, that Mr. Shamrock was looking for. He was looking for what Mr. White insisted be included in the contract. Mr. Shamrock only wanted a one-fight deal. It was Mr. White who insisted upon two bouts. Mr. Shamrock acquiesced and then agreed to those promotional exclusivity provisions and adhered to them. Mr. Campbell has said that there's no evidence that he had any other opportunities or that he did any of these things. Well, that's because the contract prohibited him from it. He may have been able to do other things, but he had many lucrative opportunities that he couldn't pursue during that eight-month period when after Zuffa made one election and then changed his mind and made another one. As to the standard of review on paragraph 10.3, Zuffa states on the one hand that the contract is unambiguous, but then on the other hand states that there's all this extrinsic evidence that supports its position. Well, you can't have both. If a contract is unambiguous, extrinsic evidence is not to be considered. It is our position, again, that the contract is indeed unambiguous, but that it is unambiguous that Zuffa did not have the right to terminate the contract when it did. As to estoppel,
there are no findings by the district court relying on Pearl evidence treating this as an ambiguous clause, though, right? Her entire findings are premised on the idea that this is clear as a matter of law.
Well, except that her statement of, may I continue
sure.
to
ahead.
Answer your question? Except that her statement or her decision is laced with, as it was pointed out, it's 16 pages long, and a good half of that, if not more, is laced with references to extrinsic evidence. If that
but to waiver concepts, waiver and estoppel.
Many of it related to evidence that related to what 10.3 or recital G meant.
Okay, then following up, you would agree that it is substantial evidence. If the contract is ambiguous, she had substantial evidence to support her reading of it?
We have not taken the position that there is, I'm going to speak in double negatives, we have not taken the position that there is no substantial evidence to support an unambiguous interpretation. Rather, our position is that the contract is unambiguous.
Right. So to win, you have to persuade us of your legal reading of this contract.
Yes, I do.
Any further questions, Justice Gibbons?
No.
Justice Pickering?
No, thank you.
Ms. Worthington, thank you for your argument.
Thanks,
Mr. Campbell, thank you for your argument. This matter will stand submitted. It's good seeing all